Okay. I started because last week there were a few people who wanted to know what a four-room house looked like because we mentioned it when we talked about Ir David. So this is a drawing of a very elaborate four-room house. The one from Ir David, this Beit Achiel that we talked about last time, if you recall. Oh yes, and the source sheets. Thank you. That is also very important. Hopefully, Rabbi Kelman is still here. Rabbi Kelman, are you still here? Can you put the source sheets in the chat? There's very little source sheets, so don't get upset if it doesn't happen. I just cannot do it myself. I don't have a link. But don't worry, there's not so many psukim. It'll be okay. Please mute everyone. I will mute everyone. Oh, so many things to do. Okay, here we go. Let's mute everyone. Okay, Yofi. I am sorry about the source sheets, but I don't have an ability to do that right now. Okay, well, we'll be all right, and we'll send them out later if you want to look at it now.
I'll get to it
Okay.
in a sec. I'll get to it
Oh,
in a
thank you.
sec.
I didn't realize you were
And
still here.
yeah,
Okay.
okay. Okay.
So let's look back at our four-room house for a second, just because it's kind of nice to understand what we're talking about. Yes, no. So when we say four-room house, what do we mean? We don't really mean four rooms. It's a basic structure. It's essentially kind of a U-shaped structure, right? You have a room, you have a room, and you have a room. Okay. And in this case, room is used very broadly. It could be two stories like Beit Achiel. It doesn't have to be only one room, but it's the basic architecture. And in the middle, you have this open courtyard area. This is a very intelligent idea. The concept being that you want to have light, you want to have air. And in an era before there was clear glass, or before pretty much anybody had glass, unless you were very, very wealthy, the only way you could really make a window was with, if it was very, very small and very high up. You don't want animals coming in or thieves or dirt. So how do you have light and air? You have this open area in the center. Okay, so that's just interesting to think about. And this is the classic architecture. This is a classic house in Israelite towns, right? In towns of First Temple times, biblical times, we find it in Tel Sheva, and we find it in Jerusalem, and we find it in Chatzor, and we find it all over the place. Okay. And like I said, it could be very small and basic. It could be much larger. And one last thing about four-room house, and then we'll move on. What's fascinating about this house is a suggestion by an archaeologist named Avi Faust. He says this is a house that does two different things that are both important for the culture of ancient Israel. Number one, each room has its own separate entrance, right? Each room you come into independently. This is opposed to, I'll just draw it on the side, what we would in modern times call a railroad flat, which is a classic design for a house, right? You come in and you go through one room and then to the next room and then to the next room. Obviously, the luckiest person is the person who lives in the back room because nobody walks through their rooms. The people in the rooms in the front, they are in descending order of importance. So if everybody has their own entrance, there's a certain element of democracy, right? Everybody's room is equal. That's number one. Number two, the other thing that's nice about everybody having their own entrance is, of course, we place a great emphasis in the Torah on purity and impurity. So, for example, the woman of the house has her period. She's impure. She can stay in her room and nobody has to walk through her room and become impure on the way to the other rooms. So that's Avi Faust's theory about the four-room house. I think it's very nice. But again, it was the style. It was just what everybody had, just like, you know, everybody had ranch houses in the 1970s, right? So that's just kind of a neat thing. All right. Let's get to our actual topic. So like I said, today we're going to focus on, we're going to do a little outline of Sefer Melachim. We're going to focus on King Solomon and his empire. As we mentioned last time, and we'll mention a little bit this time, this all ties into a very large debate in archaeology, which is still ongoing, which is, do we take the stories of Tanakh, and particularly these earlier stories, at face value? How much power did David have? How much power did Shlomo have? Were they really these monarchs that controlled vast areas, or were they more like tribal chieftains? And if earlier generations, finds, let's say, from the 1930s with archaeologists like William Albright through the 50s and 60s with Yigael Yadin, earlier generations looked in Tanakh and said, of course they're as powerful as Tanakh says they are. We are taking Tanakh as a very reliable source. 70s, 80s, 90s, the pendulum swung in the other way. And essentially they said, no, these guys, if they existed at all, are people who were just tribal chieftains and didn't have a lot of power. And in the last 20 years, the pendulum is swinging back again, and we're finding more and more proofs that perhaps they're not quite as powerful as Tanakh says, but they definitely were rulers who controlled large areas. So that's one of the things we're going to talk about today with Shlomo as well. The picture you are looking at is part of the top of a column, okay, a capital. This particular capital, if you know a little architecture, you might know Doric capitals, Ionic capitals. This is called a Proto-Aeolic capital, which is found in lots of places, but the earliest ones are found in the land of Israel. And not only that, they are found in places that had some kind of royal presence. So we find them in the city of Shomron, which was a royal city. And we're going to find them, as we're going to see, in Megiddo and in Hatzor and in Jerusalem. And when we find them, we say, aha, maybe there was a palace here, because some of the places we found them in did have palaces, and we assume that this is a very fancy kind of architecture that you would find only in a palace. Okay, so we're going to come back to that. We're going to see it in Chatzor a little bit later. Okay, as we've been doing for the whole course, a quick look at the first book of Kings. Like we said with Sefer Shmuel, same thing. This is an artificial division. There isn't really a Kings 1 and a Kings 2. And in fact, in the summary, what I did is I made it a little bit more logical. I brought in the first few chapters of Malachim Bet, of the second book of Kings, because thematically it works, right? It fits. It continues from the first book of Kings. So just to give us a little bit of an outline, and in 2 times we'll do Malachim Bet. Okay, so the first two chapters are essentially the last days, the cleanup of King David's kingdom. The book opens in kind of a sad way, right? We're so used to King David and his height of his power and his masculinity and his courage in the book of Samuel. And here he is, an old man who can't get warm, and everybody's plotting around him. It was kind of a sad beginning to the book. We also have the struggle for succession, right? David has a lot of children. We've already had Avshalom, who was killed, but now he has another son named Adoniah, who tries to make himself king, and Natan Hanavi, who is a supporter of Shlomo and not of Adoniah, allies himself with Bathsheba, Shlomo's mother, and they go before King David because they know that if Adoniah becomes king, that's the end of them, because they are supporting the other party. And they come before King David and they say, you promised that your son Solomon, Bathsheba's son, will become king. And he promises, and he has him already crowned in his lifetime. Okay. The other thing that happens in those first two chapters is David says to Solomon, he says, you're a smart man, and I have certain scores that I need you to settle for good and for bad, right? And this is a fascinating story, right? People who had it in for David when he was running away from Avshalom, and David didn't do anything, but now he says, you'll figure out what to do, Shlomo, and also reward the people who need to be rewarded. Okay, then we have a nice section from chapter 3 till chapter 11 is all about Shlomo HaMelech, okay, with an interesting trajectory, right? The first few chapters are about his foreign policy, his domestic policy, his wisdom, right? We have the famous story where he goes and he has a conversation with God, and God says, what do you want? And he says, I want wisdom. Right. And wisdom is, of course, the key to getting everything else. And then, of course, we have the very, very famous story where his wisdom is proved by the two women who come, my baby, we'll cut the baby in half. Ah, that shows that who the true mother is. Okay, so that's our first few chapters. Then we have quite a nice section devoted to building the temple, building the Beit HaMikdash. All the cities we're going to talk about today, by the way, are essentially dismissed in about one verse. Okay, but they're very important, and we have archaeology from them, as opposed to not having anything from the temple. Okay, so it seems like Shlomo is at the height of his powers. He's controlling all these places. He has very profitable marriages. Come
Alliances,
on. whoever is on,
Recording in
please mute
progress.
here. I will mute you. Okay, and things seem to be going well for him. And then, of course, he commits this terrible sin of the king of having too much of everything, too much money, too many horses, and especially too many wives, right? Because his wives, as wives do, lead him astray into idolatry. And this is the end of the United Kingdom. God says it's not going to work, right? And you're going to be punished, and part of your kingdom is going to be taken away from you, not in your lifetime, but afterwards. Chapter 12, and we'll talk about this at the end of the class. The kingdom is divided. How does it happen? And from that point on, right, till the kingdom of Israel is exiled, we have the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah. The two are not reunited. Okay. The next few chapters is about Yeravam, Yeravam, who is the first king of Israel, right, of the divided kingdom of Israel. And we also have simultaneously, of course, Rehoboam, who is King Solomon's son, and their successors and their families. Chapter 16, there are various coups. All right. We'll see the succession of the kings in a minute. But then the very powerful King Omri comes to power. He is the founder of a dynasty, right? The Omrid dynasty, whose most famous king is Ahab. And we're going to talk about him next time. I have a whole class about Ahab and Eliyahu because he's a fascinating character. And we have quite a lot of chapters about the house of Omri, right? From chapter 17 till the end of the book of the first Kings. And then the first few chapters of second Kings is all about not only Ahab, but also his successor, and what happens in the downfall of their kingdom. Okay, so that's just to give us a little bit of a background. And then for those of us who have always been challenged by the many, many, many similar names of kings, and this is actually in the source sheets. I took this from Wikipedia, and it happens to be very helpful because these names are killers, right? And who goes with who, and how do they fit in? The only thing that's really missing here, which I will try to find for you a nice chart, is which prophets go where. But we'll do it Baal Peh for a minute. Okay, so we have the early kings, right? The early kings who are the united kings. Shaul, even he's not so united. Okay, by the way, all of the dotted lines are coups, basically, right? The person who comes along, kills the previous king or overtakes the previous king, and then becomes the next king. And you will notice that in the kingdom of Judah, there are almost no coups. There's only one over here, this very interesting story we'll talk about in a second. But there is just a nice, neat dynasty that goes all the way from King David all the way down, as opposed to the kingdom of Israel, where you do have various dynasties, right? And in particular, like we said, Omri, but then each time the dynasty is ended, kicked out by an upstart who starts his own new dynasty, and ultimately is kicked out as well. Okay, so just to get a quick look here, right? David, Shlomo, Rehavam. At that point, we have the beginning of the kingdom of Israel. Okay, we have Rehavam's dynasty that goes all the way to Yehoram. Then we have the strange story of Ataliah, Ahaziah. Ataliah is the woman, the only queen we have, who kills all her grandchildren, except for one who's hidden away, Yehoash, and then the line continues, right? And the line continues all the way until the end of First Temple times. Okay. And again, Jehoiakim is kicked out, Jehoiachin is put in by the Babylonians, then he's sent into exile. So we do have a little shifting at the end, but essentially it is a relatively stable kingdom with mostly, I won't say mostly, partly good kings, right? We have some few very, very righteous kings. For example, Chizkiyahu, right? Hezekiah, Yoshiyahu, Josiah. We have some, let's say, Parif kings. They're not so good. They're not so bad. Rehavam, Yehoram, right? And then we have some kings who are definitely not good, right? Like Menasheh. Like Jehoiakim, but it's a mixed bag. In the kingdom of Israel, on the other hand, most of the kings are idolaters and do not do so much for the people. And hence we have a lot of instability. So we have Yerovam, the first, right, the first person who breaks away, and he has a son. It's a very short dynasty. Baasha comes in and a coup, and he has one son, another coup, another coup. Omri comes in, and he has this relatively powerful dynasty, okay, but ultimately kicked out by Yehu. Okay, and Yehu starts his own dynasty. And finally, we end up with this time period where you have many different insurrections, and ultimately the Assyrians come and get rid of the entire kingdom of Israel, conquer it, and that's the end. Okay, one other thing I'll point out while we have this in front of us, just because it's such a nice little chart. The time of Yerovam and Uzziah, they are contemporaries. This chart is the only thing that's not nice about it is it doesn't match up so much. So Yerovam and Uzziah are contemporaries. They live at the time of the prophet Amos. This is a time of peace and prosperity in both kingdoms. Okay, it's interesting. Sometimes the kingdom of Judah is doing well. Sometimes the kingdom of Israel is doing well. Sometimes they're both doing badly, but it is rare that they both are doing well. And that's what happens with Yerovam and Uzziah. The last thing I will show you here is that we're going to talk about places like Megiddo. The question is, who built this powerful city? Was it King Solomon? Okay. Or was it Ahav, Ahab? There's about 100 years, a little less, 75 years separating the two. So just to keep those in mind. Handy dandy chart, well worth printing out and keeping with you for all useful references. Okay. Let's continue on to King Solomon. Okay. So, we have King Solomon is considered, at least by Tanakh, to be the pinnacle of the success of the United Kingdom. Okay. He has power. He has wisdom. He rules righteously. And of course, he builds the temple, which is the ultimate community project, right? And it's the ultimate, finding a place for God's presence in the world, right? The Menucha and the Nachala. So this is the classic, you know, idyllic utopian time. And it's not that King Solomon doesn't do things, like doesn't put burdens on the people. There's a very heavy tax burden to do all these great projects. But what's fascinating is that when Rehavam, his son, tries to impose that same tax burden, the people rebel. Why? Because with Solomon, when he asked for the money, he gave them something in return, right? He said, I am going to give you this incredible institution. You're going to be part of it. You're going to build the temple to God. And at that point, people said, okay, I'll give the money. But when Rehavam is coming along, it's interpreted as greed, right? A large project that brings people together, they're much more willing to open up their wallets, right? Interesting point for rulers everywhere. Okay, like I said before, we don't get too much information about what happens outside of Jerusalem, but we have this verse, and this is a very important verse, okay, in chapter 9. And this is the account of the levy, right? The taxes, but not really taxes. It's more work, right? A work levy, which King Solomon raised. Why did he raise this? To build the house of the Lord and his own house and the Milo and the wall of Jerusalem. So these are all things in Jerusalem, right? The temple, his palace, the expanded neighborhood from Ir David, the Milo, and the wall of Jerusalem, which we're going to look at in the picture below in a minute. And almost as an afterthought, Chatzor, Megiddo, and Gezer, which are the places we're going to talk about the most. Okay. Besides Jerusalem, he builds three, according to this verse, three royal cities. Why these particular places? We're going to see in a minute why these particular places, Chatzor, Megiddo, and Gezer. But these are King Solomon's royal projects. Everything in Jerusalem plus these other cities. Now, what have we found from King Solomon in Jerusalem? Okay, obviously we have not found anything from the temple. A, because we can't excavate on the Temple Mount, although we're finding things from First Temple times in the sifting project and various other places. But B, because Solomon's temple is not that big, and along comes King Herod, and he builds something so monumental that everything below it is erased. But it doesn't mean that we don't have anything from King Solomon's temple. So this great picture here, this young woman standing on it, this is a 40 meter long section of a wall. You can see it's actually two walls, right? If you look at it carefully, you could see there's a wall here, but there's another wall below it. Okay. The wall above is a wall from Byzantine times from 1500 years ago. Hey, it happens to be very close to the city wall from Ottoman Turkish times, but this below is a wall that goes back to First Temple times. How do I know that? I know it from the construction. It's not particularly sophisticated. It's not particularly strong. I know it from the pottery that was found below. And this is a First Temple period wall. The person who excavated it, Eilat Mazar, says this is King Solomon's wall. This is the wall that he builds when he adds to the city to include the Temple Mount, right? Not just the city of David, but he adds to the city. And part of the reason that she is sure that this is King Solomon's wall and not a later wall is, I apologize, this is rather blurry, okay? But this wall, which you can see over here, okay, is actually attached to another building, which, based on the pottery that was found here and the fill and all sorts of other interesting things, this is part of King Solomon's palace. Okay. And this is part of the inner gate that led into this whole compound. Okay. So this is an area that is by the southern wall excavations, right? If you know a little by the where the western wall is, right next to the western wall, we have excavations that were done starting after the Six-Day War by Benjamin Mazar. Much of what was found is Second Temple, right? From the height of Second Temple times, but he also found stuff from First Temple times. And he was the first one to uncover this structure, which seems to be something, a storeroom, an adjacent room to the royal palace. And it dates back to the 10th century before the Common Era, to the time of King Solomon. Okay, there's other parts next to it. There's a tower over here that comes back to Uzziah. Not everything is Solomon, but it fits nicely with this time period. The wall, the palace go back to the time of King Solomon, according to Eilat Mazar. And this is what we have of King Solomon in Jerusalem up until now. Who knows? Maybe we'll find more. Okay, the temple, like I said, we have a great description. We have lots of description in the Book of Kings, but we don't have any artifacts from it, or practically any artifacts from it. But this is his great project. It requires enormous amounts of manpower and of gold. By the way, we're finding some proofs maybe in copper mines that are being excavated in Jordan. There was a huge amount of copper that was excavated at this time. And if you read the text, there's tons of metal that's used in the temple. How did Solomon get all of this? Because there are mines that he is using, that he is taking advantage of. One of the beautiful things about the Beit HaMikdash, and we have a whole prayer that King Solomon prays at the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash, is that it is meant to be a universal place. It's not only for the people of Israel. It's not only to come and to give sacrifices, but the idea is that anyone from any nation in the world is supposed to be able to come and to talk to God and to supplicate him. And it's meant to be a universal place as well as a place that is particular to Israel. Okay, so that's just a little about the temple. Again, like I said, Halavai, one day we'll have more. Right now, we don't have very much. So we are going to focus on the three cities that we have here, because we do have a lot from them and they are very important. Okay, so one of the things that's fascinating is that these three cities share certain characteristics. The most obvious one, and the one that's the easiest to show, is that they have the same six-chambered gate, right? When I say six-chambered gate, one, two, three, four, five, six. We're going to see them very nicely. Particularly in Gezer, you can see them very nicely, right? Gates in ancient times are not just an archway or not just an opening into a city, but there are a lot of things that happen at the gates, and there are all these chambers in the gates. So we find four-chambered gates, six-chambered gates. This is a classic Israelite design. We find it in Tel Sheva. We find it here in Gezer and Megiddo and Hazor. We find it in Kayafa, right? Because at the gate, you need a place for the soldiers to guard, and you need a place for the judges to sit, and you need a place to have some kind of ritual sacrifices, and you need a place to collect taxes. So six-chambered gates is a classic Israelite style. We find them in these three cities. Now, there are those who will argue with this, but for example, Yigael Yadin, right? When he dug in Megiddo, he found the six-chamber gate. He went back to look at the records of Gezer, and he saw there was a six-chambered gate. Yigael Yadin knew the pasuk that said Chatzor, Megiddo, Gezer, And when he dug in Chazor, he said, well, if King Solomon thought it was good to put a six-chambered gate in Gezer and a six-chambered gate in Megiddo, I'm betting that he did it in Chazor as well. And he actually drew for his workers this outline on the ground. He said, dig and you're going to find this, right? King Eliyahu was definitely a showman. And they did. And they dug and they found it, right? And there is a six-chambered gate. Now, others will say, ah, oh, very nice. Six-chambered gate is not exclusive to Solomon. He didn't have, the copyright on it. Other people could build it too. But it is nice to be able to find parallels in these cities that were supposed to have been built at the same time by the same designer. Okay. Also, all three of these cities were not built by Solomon. Okay. They are built on the remains of existing cities. All three of them were powerful Canaanite cities in the Middle Bronze Age. Okay. Cities that have been at their height of power when the Canaanites are around after the conquest by Joshua or a little bit later. They are taken by Israel, usually later, right? Especially in Megiddo. These were places that were not conquered right away. And King Solomon comes to these places which already have a legacy of being important, and they're important because of where they're located on main roads. And he says, I'm going to build cities here as well. Okay, so this brings us to our next point. Why these three, right? Obviously, people lived in other cities besides these three. Why does Tanakh feel it necessary to tell us about Jerusalem? Jerusalem, we understand. Gezer, Megiddo, Chazor. So what you can see in this map is two things. Number one, all three cities are along what's called the Via Maris, okay? More or less. Gezer is a little too far inland, but okay, we're going to pretend. They're all along what's called the route of the sea, Derech Hayam, which is the main trading route in ancient times, right? You come up from Egypt, you go along the coast, you go a little inland, you go up towards the Jezreel Valley, and then you either cross over by Megiddo or you continue up towards Chazor and you continue out towards the northeastern empires. So each of these cities is strategically located for trade, for defense. These are good cities to be in charge of. These are good cities to rule over. Okay. So that's one very significant element. The other one is that these cities are in different parts of the country, right? Chazor in the far north, Megiddo more or less in the center, Gezer heading towards the south. What is the shorthand here that Tanakh is saying? Tanakh doesn't have to say King Solomon rules over the whole country, although it says that too, right? It says King Solomon rules over these cities because these are a way of saying I'm ruling over the whole country, right? And I say the president is the president from New York to Los Angeles, right? It's a way of showing you the whole New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, right? New Yorkers, we tend to skip over the stuff in the middle. But that's what we're saying here, right? We're ruling over absolutely everything. Okay. So we're going to take a few minutes to look at each one of these cities and what was discovered there. I'm going to spend less time on Megiddo than the other two, because Megiddo we're going to come back to next week, because Megiddo is an important city not only for King Solomon, but for Ahav. And we're going to talk about Megiddo in the context of the battles between Ahav and Eliyahu. But the other two we're going to focus on here. So first of all, Gezer. Where is Gezer? We saw that very schematic map a second ago, but this is a more serious map. Okay, nice Google Maps, right? Tel Gezer right over here. Okay, today really in the heart of the country, halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Today it's kind of a quiet pastoral-ish area. It's not so far from Modi'in. It's within a small little bedroom community, and you can go and see the Tel, but it's still a very centrally located place. Okay. What was discovered there? So we have excavations in Tel Gezer going back more than 100 years. Okay. There have been more recent, very important excavations that have happened there. And we'll take a look first at the background, right? At the history. Oh, one more thing. Let's just go back for a second. Gezer is located in a very important valley. Okay. This is one of the valleys in the center and the south. We have Emek Ha'Elah, the Elah Valley down here, where we talked about David and Goliath. This is the Ayalon Valley. Emek Ayalon. We hear about Emek Ayalon with Yehoshua, right? With Joshua. If you remember, that's where the sun stands still. Okay. major passageway between the mountains and the coast. So the location also, not only is it on a main road, but it's in a valley. It's easy to get places from there. Also important. Okay. The city of Gezer was already excavated about 120 years ago by someone named William McAllister. This was still the beginnings of archaeology, and we make fun of him, but he didn't know any better. What did he do? He dug a trench. He took the dirt from the trench and dumped it out. Then he moved over a few feet. He dug another trench, and he took the dirt from trench two, and he put it in trench one. This is very bad. Do not do this in archaeology, right? You have to be very, very careful to keep your dirt separate because we want to know what pieces go together if we have broken pottery and you can't mix everything up. He didn't know any better. What can we do? But he still found some important things. Hey, but then excavations continued and we found the remains of a very powerful and important Canaanite city. By the way, how do we know this is Gezer besides its location? Because part of the excavations discovered what are called boundary stones, right? A tchum, a sign that says you've reached the border of the city. And these boundary stones, which go back to Hellenistic times, right, to third, second century before the Common Era, say Gezer. Okay, so that's pretty clear. This is the welcome to Gezer sign. This is a Canaanite city. It's a powerful Canaanite city. It's already existing 3000 BCE. It reaches its height in the mid-Bronze Age, 2000 to 1500 BCE. We know it's powerful because it's got this nice strong wall with defense towers. We're going to see it's got a very significant water system. Hey, we hear about it in the El Amarna letters. We hear about it in the Merneptah Stela, meaning the Egyptians are aware of it and deal with it. One of the things that's great about this wall, you can see it here, and I'm going to show you another picture that's more close up. You can see stone on the bottom, but can you see the top here, what it's made out of? Okay, I'll show you even better in the next slide. These are mud bricks, right? Can you see them? These are mud bricks that are 3,000, 3,500 years old. And you say, mud really is going to last? No, mud bricks can last if they are made right and they dry and they're packed in. So that's just kind of neat to see. Why would you make a wall that's partly stone and partly mud? Stone is a good foundation, but stone can be broken. Mud has more resilience. It has more flexibility. It actually can last longer, as we see it has lasted. So when the Canaanite Gezer was excavated, there were all kinds of fascinating things that were found: the walls, the towers, the water system. But they found these, what we call matzevot, standing stones, and a basin. And we're not 100% sure what this is, right? Now, the standing stones, the matzevot, seem to recall for us a form of worshiping either idols or God, right? We know that the patriarchs put up matzevot. Abraham puts up matzevot. Yaakov puts up matzevot. Eventually, these are considered to be idolatrous and they're not used anymore, but we definitely hear about them. So are these some kind of idol worship? Is it maybe some kind of an alliance, right? We have a fascinating reference to basins and blood and sprinkling blood on various participants. Where do we hear about this? After Matan Torah, after the Torah is given, right? Moshe has to make sacrifices, take the blood, put it in a basin, sprinkle it on the people, right? There's supposed to be this way of making some kind of a brit, of some kind of a connection. Maybe this is an alliance that the people of Gezer had with other towns. We don't really know. But what I think it shows us is the power of this town and of this religion, right? The Israelites do not get rid of the Canaanites, and they are plagued by them. As we talked about this in when we talked about the book of Joshua. And part of it is because their religion is very powerful and very kind of everywhere, right? You see it all over. Okay, two more short things about Canaanite Gezer. One of the earliest inscriptions that was found in our area, maybe not the earliest, there's all kinds of disagreement, but it's definitely one of the earliest, is what's called Luach Gezer, the Gezer calendar. right? You can see it over here. It's not in Israel, it's in Istanbul. If you want to go see it, it's one of the things the Turks took home. It's a little hard to read in the painting, in the photograph. You can see it in the drawing over here. What is it? It's a farmer's almanac, right? Yerach Asif, Yerach Zara, Yerach Lekesh, Yerach Atzad, right? 2 months of harvest, 2 months of sowing, 2 months of late planting. In case you're a farmer who doesn't exactly remember what to do every year, this is what you're supposed to do, right? And it's a fascinating thing that was found in Gezer, maybe not the earliest writing in our area. And finally, a very sophisticated water system. Okay, it's a tunnel that's more than 200 meters long that goes underground, an underground passageway to reach the groundwater outside the city, right? This is an idea. There's always the problem of how do you get your water and stay safe? And we're going to see water systems in Chatzor. Next week, we're going to see in Megiddo. But those are built by the Israelites. These are built by the Canaanites. This is the same time period as the water system in the city of David. It shows an incredible skill of engineering, right? That they were able to dig this and it not cave in and able to understand how to get to the water and the water level will be high enough to use it. And this has been excavated recently. But back to our story, okay? Where do we hear about any more about Gezer and King Solomon? So we heard that he builds the cities, but we have this other great pasuk, right? Paro, king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer and burnt it with fire and given it for a portion unto his daughter, Solomon's wife. If you recall, one of the many, many wives that King Solomon has is Bat Paro, the daughter of Paro. What's her name? We don't know, right? Does he marry her because she's so beautiful and he falls in love with her? Maybe, but more likely he marries her because she's a good alliance, right? That's what marriages are in the old days. Certainly marriages among kings, okay? You marry the daughter of the Paro is going to be friendly to you. And the way that the Paro was friendly to King Solomon was that he took this Canaanite city of Gezer, this very powerful city that the Israelites had not managed to conquer, and he conquers it, and he says, here, you know, it's nicer than Mikasa, China. I'm going to give you a city. And he gives him a city. Hey, now, remember we said before, gates, right? Take a look at these gates. You have a perfect six-chambered gate. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? This is outside the city. We're going into the city. The Israelite city expands beyond the walls of the Canaanite city. The other thing that's nice is you can see this down here. This is a drainage ditch that was below the level of the gates and the street. Gives you a sense of a very well-planned city. Okay. The gate, like we said, is a very important place, but also the architecture is important for us because it tells us this is the style we're going to see in other places. Now, how do we know it's the time of King Solomon besides the architecture? So recent excavations, I think it's the Southern Baptist University, they dug and right next door to the gates, right? You guys can see the gates here very nicely, right? And right next door, they found a large structure that dates, based on the pottery, dates to the 10th, 9th century, and it was destroyed. So first of all, dating it to the 10th, 9th slash 9th century is very nice because that's the time of King Solomon. But even nicer, not for the people, but for us, is that it was destroyed. Why? Because we know that after King Solomon's time, in the time of King Rehoboam, his son, another Paro comes, a less friendly Paro, and his name is Paro Shishak, or Sheshank in the Egyptian chronicles, and he comes and he destroys a lot of cities in Yehuda, and Gezer seems to be one of them. So the palace seems to be dated to King Solomon. And if the palace is dated to King Solomon and the gate is contiguous to it, the gate can also be dated to King Solomon. So Gezer seems to be very nice, and many archaeologists agree that Gezer does go back to King Solomon and fits nicely with Tanakh, with what Tanakh tells us. Okay, Megiddo, like I said, we're going to do only just a little bit, but Megiddo is also incredibly important location. Okay, here's Megiddo up on top. The tell is right over here. It is the gateway to the Jezreel Valley. This is the major thoroughfare. We talked about this when we did the battles in Shoftim, how important the Jezreel Valley is. If you control if you control Megiddo, you control the merchants who come through and the tariffs they have to pay and the armies that can come through. And anybody who's going through the valley is going to have to come to you. And everybody wants to control Megiddo. The first battle in our area in recorded history, Thutmose, right? Thutmose, king of Egypt in the 14th century, is at Megiddo, all the way up to General Allenby in World War I. So this is a super important place. And if King Solomon can take it and control it and build it up, and as we're going to see, Ahav does that as well, it's a sign of his power. Okay, so here we have even nicer than, well, not nicer, the photography was nicer, but this is helpful, right? Here's Megiddo. This photo was taken, this screenshot was taken during the height of Corona when the park was closed. Okay, and here's the valley, right? Here's the valley, nice big triangle. Okay, with the base over in the east, and you can cross through the valley, and Megiddo is the entryway to that valley. Now, it's a Canaanite city, but it is then eventually becomes an Israelite city. One of the items that was found in one of Megiddo was excavated many times, and like I said, we'll talk more about it next week. But one of the excavators was in the late 19th century. His name was Gottlieb Schumacher, and he discovered a seal that had a roaring lion on it, and nice ancient Israelite writing, right? Ancient Hebrew writing says Shema Eved Yeravam, Shema, the servant of Yeravam, of Jeroboam. Okay, Yeravam here is not the guy who makes the breakaway kingdom, but Yeravam the second, right? I showed you him in our king's chart. He's a good 150 years later. So he's a king here, but are there kings here before that, right? Is he the first Israelite king here? It seems not, right? So again, we have gates, right? We have these nice gates. Today, we actually only have three chambers, one, two, three. Why? Because the excavators from Chicago who dug here in the 1920s actually packed up the other side of the gate and took it home. So you can see actually in old photographs, you can see both of them. But here we only have three. Okay, so you can say, okay, very nice. Same planning, same architecture that we had in Gezer and that we're going to see in Hazor, right? We have an inner gate, we have an outer gate, right? This is this kind of the scenario that you have. The inner gate is the six chambers. The outer gate goes down to the road. Is this gate a gate that goes back to Solomon, or is it a gate that is not quite as old, but a little bit younger? And this is the controversy among excavators in Megiddo. Is Megiddo the powerful city? Was it started, the Israelite city, by King Solomon? Or does it take another 75 years? And it started by Ahav, by Ahab, right? And the question is about the style. Is it a casement wall? Is it not a casement wall? We're not going to go so deeply into it. But one of the things that's important to understand about Megiddo is there are two major levels to the Israelite city. There's a level of palaces, two large palaces, and above that, there's a level of stables. Now, we're going to talk about stables when we talk about Ahav. But the question is, if the palaces belong to King Solomon, then the stables belong to Ahav. But if you push everything later, which some archaeologists do because they say, no, King Solomon didn't rule here, then the palaces belong to Ahav, and the stables are our friend Yerovam the second, who we saw in the seal. So this is a debate among archaeologists. It's not a consensus, but there are quite a few really senior archaeologists who will definitely say that King Solomon is the one who starts the Israelite city. We're going to come to Ahav next week, so we're going to leave behind Megiddo, and we're going to go up to Hazor. All the way up in the north. Hazor is an enormous tell. It's the largest one in the country. There's an upper city and there's a lower city. The lower city is the Canaanites. The Canaanites had both. The upper city is only the Israelites. I said that wrong. The Canaanites ruled in the lower city and in the upper city. When the Israelites come, they only rule over the upper city. It was a super powerful mid-bronze Canaanite city, like Gezer, like Megiddo. When it becomes an Israelite city, it's much, much, much smaller, right? But it's still a very, very important location. This is a great photograph, this aerial photograph. I hope you all can see the six-chambered gate. We're going to see it up close, but here it is, right? Here's our six-chambered gate. Okay, so Hatzor is probably the most unappreciated archaeological site in Israel. It's an amazing, amazing place, and no one visits it. Where is it? Okay, it's all the way up here, not far from Tzfat, not far from Hatzor HaGlilit, the modern Hatzor, right? Again, on a main road, super important trade center. We have evidence of the Canaanite city trading with Egypt, with Mesopotamia. We found all different kinds of fascinating artifacts. And in the Canaanite city, Canaanite city, which was mostly excavated by Yigael Yadin, in the 60s. Today we focus more on the upper city. But in the lower city, there was this incredible large ritual area, again, showing us that power of the Canaanite religion, matzevot, standing stones, all kinds of idols and statues and baals, okay? But this is in the lower city. In the upper city, we have some enormous structure as well from Canaanite times. Temple, palace, not 100% clear which it is. It has a large altar outside. What's important for us, and we talked about this when we did the Joshua class, is that it was clearly consumed in an enormous fire, and we can date that fire to the 12th century, meaning Hatzor is one of those nice places where the story in Tanakh and the story in archaeology match up beautifully. Tanakh tells us that of all the northern cities, only Hatzor is destroyed by Joshua. And here we have the archaeology, Hatzor is destroyed by Joshua. So it's a powerful, powerful Canaanite city for centuries, destroyed by Joshua, rebuilt on a very small scale by the Israelites. They really don't do much until along comes King Solomon, and he builds that fabulous six-chambered gate again. Right? Now, again, can we date this to King Solomon? So before we answer that question, here are our nice proto-Aeolic columns. You don't see them on the site of Hatzor because they have been brought to the Israel Museum and set up there. They were actually discovered. It's fascinating. You can see old pictures of them. They were discovered in kind of just covered in dirt. They had been used by the local Arabs as like a little bit of an enclosure to make a fire, right? So that your fire, when your bonfire doesn't get out of control, they had used these stones. I thought they were pretty. They used these stones. Fortunately, archaeologists found them, saved them. And as we said, these are signs of a royal city. So if you're finding these, that's a great clue, but it doesn't tell us King Solomon, right? However, right next to that six-chambered gate, similar to what we saw in Gezer, there was a house that was excavated. It was a house that was built into the wall. Okay? The top layer, based on the pottery, is from the 9th century, meaning the three lower layers go back even earlier, and that takes us back to King Solomon. So it seems, just to draw our conclusions for a moment, many, many archaeologists will agree Gezer and Hatzor were built by King Solomon. Megiddo, questionable, maybe, probably King Solomon. We don't know 100% for sure. And Jerusalem, we don't have enough evidence yet. We need to excavate more. Okay, but that's important for us to keep in mind when we're talking about these cities. Here's our nice gates yet again. Okay, and you can really see the similarities very well. What else has been found in Hatzor? A large storehouse building, and the water system. Okay, we said every city has to figure out how to solve this water problem, right? What do you do about water, which is often either too low to be encompassed by a wall or further outside the city? You need to figure out a way to bring the water inside. Probably the most ingenious one from Israelite times is in Megiddo. We'll see it next week. Chatzor is similar. You go down a very, very long staircase. You can see there's a tunnel that goes towards the groundwater. The great story about the Chatzor one is that Yigael Yadin, who was in charge of the excavation, he found an opening and he was very excited about it, but it was the end of the day. And he said to his students, okay, tomorrow we'll go in with safety equipment and we'll make sure and we'll do it in the best possible way. He goes home. And his students, Amnon Bentor, who today is the excavator in Chatzor, and David Uzishkin, they went in that day. They stuck around after Yigael Yadin went home. They were too excited to wait till the next day. They went down themselves that day and they left a little sign so that when Yigael Yadin went down the next day, what did he see? He saw a little sign written in Hebrew, Kfar Hayinu Po. We were here already. All right. Nice little archaeologist joke down there. So Chatzor, fascinating site. Next time you come back to Israel, it is very, very well worth a visit. Okay. We'll spend our last few minutes talking about the most significant event that happens in the Book of Kings, because it impacts on everything that happens later, and that is the divided kingdom, right? We mentioned last time that King David attempts to unite everyone, to unite them around Jerusalem. And what I said last time is it doesn't work in the short term, although it does work in the long term. But in the short term, it definitely doesn't work. Okay? Under King David, under King Solomon, the tribes, these very fractious tribes, are united together. But once King Solomon dies and that sense of common purpose is over, that's it. The kingdom divides up. Now, there are a number of causes, right? And Tanakh is always working on various levels. So the cause that's given as kind of the theological cause, right? King Solomon sins. He has all of these foreign wives. They cause him, even though he's the wisest man, to stray and to commit idolatry. Very, very terrible. And God says, I'm going to punish you. After you die, the kingdom's going to be taken away. Part of the kingdom is taken away. So that's the theological reason. However, we also have kind of more immediate and very practical reasons. The story, I did not bring the story here, but it is very worth reading, especially for those who like to tell people, you know, listen to your elders. Okay? The story is that Rehoboam, the young new king, is not sure what policy to pursue. And he goes to his father's advisors, the old men, and he says to them, what should I do? My father made lots of taxes. Should I continue that policy or should I ease up? And the elders say to him, you know what? It was a very heavy tax burden. Ease up a little. And then he goes to the young men, to his contemporaries, and he says to them, what do you think? And they say, you say to them, I am twice as tough as my father, right? If my father beat you with whips, I'm going to beat you with scorpions. And foolishly, Rehoboam follows the young people and not the old people. He raises the taxes and the people say, huh, you're no King Solomon. You're not your father. We're not listening to you. And that's what I brought you over here. The first book of Kings, not the exclamation book of Kings. Sorry. Chapter 12, when all Israel saw the king had not listened to them, the people answered the king, we have no portion in David, no share in Jesse's son. Ein lanu chelek b'David v'lo nachala b'ben Yishai. Lo alecha Yisrael, go to your tents, O Israel, look to your own house, O David. So the Israelites returned to their homes. Now, this is a fascinating thing. We're not interested in your newfangled ways of a united kingdom. We want to go back to the way we had it before. Everyone with their tribes and everyone with their families and everyone with their own holy places. We don't need a central place. We'll see that in 1 second. So the Israelites returned to their homes. Rehoboam continued to reign over the Israelites who lived in the towns of Judah. Now Rehoboam doesn't give up so easily. Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was in charge of the forced labor, right? Remember, taxes is work, not money. But all Israel pelted him to death with stones. Oh, very bad, right? Don't send the tax collector when everybody is angry at you. Thereupon, King Rehoboam hurriedly mounted his chariot and fled to Jerusalem, and Israel revolted against the house of David, as is still the case. When all Israel heard that Yeravam, very confusing, Yeravam, Rehoboam, had returned, they sent messengers and summoned him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. Now, it says only the tribe of Judah here. We know that as time goes on, the tribe of Benjamin also joins the kingdom of Judah. But all these guys, the kingdom of Israel, they are all going to be exiled. We're going to talk about that in two classes, and they're going to disappear from Jewish history forever. So this is a very, very fateful moment in the story. Finally, Yerovam does something else very significant. He says, what's going to bring the people back together? What united them under King Solomon? This common purpose of one temple. And so I have to get rid of that idea, because otherwise they're all going to go back to Jerusalem and they're going to say, oh, it was nice to all be together in the temple. So Yerovam said to himself, this is the continuation of that same chapter, the kingdom may return to the house of David if these people still go up to offer sacrifices at the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. The heart of these people will turn back to their master, King Rehoboam of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to King Rehoboam. So the king took counsel and made two golden calves. This is not accidental, right? Golden calves. Egel HaZahav, very ancient kind of worship. And this is what he chooses. He said to the people, you've been going to Jerusalem long enough. This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. If that sounds familiar, we read it in last week's Parsha. Okay? Whether Yerovam says this or the author of Sefer Melachim puts this in his mouth, Ela Elohecha Yisrael Asher Ha'elucha Mi Eretz Mitzrayim. And he put one in Beit El and he put one in Dan. Yerovam is very clever. Why should we have, if we're already having breakaway temples, why have only one? Make a franchise. If people who live in the north, they'll go to Dan. People who live in the south, they'll go to Beit El. Why should you all have to go to the same place? Hey, the picture I brought you here is of the ritual site in Tel Dan, all the way in the far north, where we found altars and layers upon layers upon layers of a ritual site. Okay. At Beit El, we have not found it, but it doesn't mean it's not there. Okay. And the other thing he does in Yerovam established a festival on the 15th day of the eighth month, right? When's the real festival? The 15th day of the seventh month. That's Sukkot. This is a month later. Okay. In imitation of the festival in Judah, he established one at Beit El and he ascended the altar there, on the 15th day of the eighth month, the month in which he had contrived of his own mind to establish a festival for the Israelites. Jeroboam, it's ascended the altar he had made in Beit El. I'm going to make my own temples. I'm going to make my own holidays. And making your own calendar is a great way to break away, right? To say we are not one people anymore. So this this attempt to unite everyone tragically fails. And we're going to see how tragically in two classes. But meanwhile, let's take a look and see what questions people have. Questions, comments, let's see. Classic house reminds me of the Plugat HaKotel building. That's very interesting, says Batya. Plugat HaKotel is obviously much, much, much later, but interesting. If Jerusalem had 30,000 people, and that was a large city, a large kingdom is relative.
When we moved there in 1970, it was all open. And they covered it with a roof.
Okay, it makes sense. A courtyard style is a classic style. We see it in Jerusalem in the 19th century also. Why are we saying Jerusalem had 30,000 people? Very iffy how many people Jerusalem had. Okay, let's see. Models for houses and a chart with prophets and kings. Thank you. I would be very happy to have that. Genealogical charts in the back of the new Koran. Thank you. All these great resources. Milo is not the same as Mamila. Mamila is much, much, much later Muslim times. Milo is the area between the city of David and the Temple Mount. And it's from the word lemalot, right? To fill in. It's a fill. City of David is a little hill. Temple Mount is another hill. There's a little bit of a dip in between this, and it had to be filled in. Did Solomon get copper out of the Timna mine? So the Timna mine is very interesting. There's new excavations there now, and it seems that it was Edomite. And I don't know if they're talking about Solomon. I would have to look into it. I don't know enough. A royal city is a city where a king has some kind of palace, power. Kings are not only in one place, right? We're going to see with Achav. Achav has his capital in Shomron, but he also has an important city in Megiddo, and he also has a more private, smaller place in Yisrael, right? It's not only the one city. A royal city is not a capital city, but it's a city that the king has a presence. Gezer, Megiddo, Chatzor, Gemach. Very nice. Gezer is not the carrot city. It's a Canaanite name. what are the origin and the meaning of the name? So it's a good question. I really should know. I don't know. But the Israelites don't change the names because just like today, right? If you walk around in Jerusalem, right, and you go to the neighborhood of Katamon, you'll see these big signs that say Geulim, or not Katamon, Baca, right? Geulim. Nobody calls Baca Geulim. Baca is the Arab name. The name is the name. It stays the name forever. People don't change names, right? When the Arabs come here 1400 years ago, they also don't change the names because names are just something that stick. So there's no reason for them to change it. Or even if they change it, it might not have worked. Right? But Paro is Solomon's first mentioned wife. Vayit Chatein. Chatein is the Chitun economic alliance. Okay, very nice. Tel Shiloh has buildings with lots of rooms as the walls. Exactly, that's the style. The lower city of Chatzor is dated by pottery, by very little inscriptions, but a little bit, by the style of the idols that are there, so many different things. The six chambers of the gates are used for all the things that are done at the gate, right? Judging, trade, tax collecting, so many different things that happen at the gate. The gate is the center of life in biblical times, right? Eshet Chayil, her husband is known at the gate. Rechavam, broad United Kingdom, Year of Am, separate dispute nation. Very nice. Very nice name derivation and also a helpful way to tell them apart. Okay. It was not the norm for Paro to marry out. Yes, that is something that people say, that the Paros did not marry their daughters outside of Egypt. And therefore, if they're doing that, then King Solomon is clearly somebody very significant, right? Nice point. Did the people follow Yerovam with his style of pagan worship? For sure. For sure, because we don't hear of any rebellion, right? They don't pick themselves up and all go to Jerusalem. Clearly, they're doing what's being done. We hear about the sacrifices at the altars in Beit El. Yerovam is crowned in Shechem. Okay, Beit El is his religious center, but Shechem is his capital. Right, we have the same names as Indian places. Very nice. The capitals are also found in the city of David and in Ramat Rachel. Correct. They are not in Ashkelon. Ramat Rachel, Jerusalem, like city of David. They just found a few on the promenade in Jerusalem. Actually, interesting. We think there was a royal building there as well. Chatzor, Megiddo, Gezer, Shomron. There might be more, but that's what I'm remembering. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Sorry about the confusion at the beginning, but we got on
hello,
time.
Hello.
Yes. Next. Oh, Rabbi Kalman is back.
I just
next
got
week,
here.
We are back to, we are with Eliyahu, prophet of fire.
Okay. The prophet of fire, like Rabbi Israel, who is in the middle, of course, the series, 10 parts on Eliyahu. But that's, I always love when different people give talk, you know, shiurim on similar topics, but as that's our Tuesday class at 1 p.m. Thank you, Shuli. Nice to see you once in a while. Hope all is well. Regards from chat. And this evening, 8:30 p.m., Rabbi David Grundland, who's works in Kiruv here in Toronto, a former member of the YU Kollel here in Toronto, will be giving our parshas here. That's this evening at 8:30 p.m. And my sitter shear 9 a.m. in the morning. And on Sunday morning, Rabbi Liebtag is starting a new series, Prophets and Psalmists, as biblical exegetes. So Tehillim and Nevi'im as Parshanim of the Chumash in the more, you know, easy way to understand the Hebrew. That will be Sunday morning, his regular time slot at 11:15. We look forward to learning with you all. Please invite a friend and all our regular classes next week. Megillat Esther and Prophet of Fire, and next week we'll be in Madrid. Wednesday, Mark Shapiro continues our Jewish communities around the world, places we have visited. So at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, we'll be in Madrid, Spain, virtually. And please God in the summer, actually. So we'll see how, please God, that all works out. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful day. Nice to see you all. Sorry, I am in school, as maybe some of you have noticed, and transferred. That's why I have my mask, and we have very strict masking rules in Ontario, as I think people know by now. Okay. I have a wonderful
thank
day.
You. Thanks. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Okay. Be well, everybody. Bye bye.
Shabbat shalom. Thank you. Bye.